This is Fresh Air. That's Eddie Harris, recorded live in 1983 at Joel Siegel's Jazz Showcase in Chicago. Hearing musicians in concert will sometimes tell you things about them you might never have heard on more controlled studio sessions. My guest Joel Dorn has produced his share of studio dates by such performers as Bette Midler, the Neville Brothers, and Roberta Flack. He's produced 16 gold records. But his new record label, Night Records, is devoted to live recordings. What especially interests him is live recordings made by amateurs and club owners where the musicians didn't even realize they were being recorded. He's auditioned about 250,000 hours of tape so far. There are 4 records in the label's first release, featuring Eddie Harris, Rossin Roland Kirk, Cannonball Adderley, and Les McCann. You get to hear the musicians speak. Here's Harris again from a 1978 performance at the Keystone Corner in San Francisco.
While we're getting ready here, I would like to take time to inform you that the bassist is not late. They had a misunderstanding in the situation of the schedule this evening. So I want you to know that, those of you sitting out there mad at the bass player. You there? I just wanted to clear the air, you know, because that's where it used to be when I was coming in the club and the cat come in. Damn, I paid my money and the cat be late. He's not late. We were early, see?
So how'd you get access to these recordings? How did you even find out about the recordings that were done behind the musician's back?
I have a friend named Bernard Drayton, who is black. When he was young, which was the late 50s, early 60s, there were no black recording engineers in the studios in New York. There just weren't. But he wanted to become a recording engineer. So he bought his own little Radio Shack level remote equipment. I'm talking about a tape recorder, a microphone, a mixing board. Prevailed upon the jazz musicians in New York. He was one of those kids, you know, who was always backstage or trying to get in clubs or stuff. Prevailed upon the musicians that when they worked their gigs, not in Manhattan, not at Birdland or the Village Gate or those places, but when they worked out in the boroughs, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and these little tiny clubs, when they would get their material together for their recordings for the New York jazz labels, they let him record these gigs under the set of rules for it was you could never release it, and it was just, you know, basically it was give a brother a break, you know. They were letting him record these gigs so that he could learn how to become a recording engineer, and he did it with the understanding that he would never release them or play them for anybody else. Boom. It's 30 years later. I'm sitting in his office in November of 1986. And we had talked about these tapes off and on for years. And we had a meeting about something else and casually said to him, I said, Bernie, maybe we should do something with those tapes of yours. Now it's 30 years later. Let me see if I can go get the clearances. So I put the time in. We got the clearances.
Did your friend Bernie Drayton record the Eddie Harris record?
No. That was done by two people. Number one, a club owner in San Francisco named Todd Barkin, who had a club called Keystone Corner for 13 years. And very quietly, he recorded every single set by every artist that ever came through that place. He had a tape collection of close to 3,000 cassettes.
This is bootleg too, right?
Well, bootleg's an interesting word. They're not bootlegs until you try and sell them. They're just unauthorized recordings
but the musicians
authorized
didn't know.
But not for sale. I would say 80% of the cases the musicians didn't know. The Eddie Harris record was done partially in Todd Barkin's club. And then there's an interesting story. There is a club in Chicago where the owner is known to do some recording now and again when people aren't looking. Eddie Harris was playing this club, knew about it, brought a friend of his in who patched in to the house sound system behind the back of the man who was recording behind the back of Eddie Harris. And we got those tapes from Eddie Harris, so we had some stuff from San Francisco, some stuff from Chicago, and we called it A Tale of Two Cities, you know.
No, and the Eddie Harris record, one of the tracks, has him doing basically like an impersonation of Billie Holiday, but he's not singing, he's kind of doing it into his saxophone.
That particular cut was done in San Francisco at the Keystone Corner, And what he does is he does an impersonation of Billie Holiday through some kind of electronic thing that he does through the saxophone, so he evokes that Billie Holiday sound without actually ever saying words. It's vocalese. But the strings and the piano, he plays them too. And they're operated by foot controls. So he stands on stage alone with a saxophone. It looks like he's playing it, but he's singing into it. With his left foot, he controls the piano. With his right foot, he controls the string orchestra. And he just does it.
The Ross and Roland Kirk sessions that you used.
Once again, that was done in San Francisco at Keystone Corner, but also in New Orleans and also in Paris. A variety of sources. We listened to 178 tapes to get, I think, 53 minutes of Rassan. And I had made 17 albums with him when he was alive, so while we found stuff that was releasable, I wanted to, once again, add to his body of recorded work. And do it in a way, we had a set of rules when he was alive that we would never do the same thing twice. So I didn't want to repeat things that he had done or areas he had covered.
You mentioned you recorded a lot of sessions with him. There's a great story that you have about how he tried to show you what it's like to be blind. He was a blind,
yeah, he was blind.
Saxophonist. So what's the story?
We went into mix one of his albums, which is where you take all the sound on the tape and put it in proportion and get it ready to be released as a record. Prior to mixing the album, he had casually said, we're not going to mix this record until you can mix it like me. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, sit down. And he's wrapping his stuff. He grabbed a roll of masking tape and started to wrap it around my head like mummy style. And he left a little room for me to breathe, but he wrapped my entire head in masking tape. After he wrapped the tape around my head, he put a gun to my head. And that... I stopped for a second. I said, what's going on? You know, he said, I want you to know what it feels like for me all the time, blind and with a gun to his head. He wasn't crazy, and it wasn't a hysterical scene. I think he was trying to make a point, obviously a point well taken with your head wrapped in a gun pointing at you. But I got the message.
My guest is Joel Dorn, the creator of Night Records, a new record label devoted to live music. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Record producer Joel Dorn is my guest. One of the things that Kirk used to always do at conferences was play three horns at one time, three saxophones at a time.
Right.
And you have an example of him doing that on the record. Why did you want to get an example of him doing that live?
Well, number one, it was kind of the thing that people spoke about. When you speak of Rassan Roland Kirk, they'll say, well, he was the blind guy who, and they'll always say... played three horns at once. That was, you know, his trademark. I remember the first time I saw it was here in Philadelphia at the Academy of Music in 1961. And I was watching backstage when he put those three horns in his mouth. The first time I saw him, he was imitating the Ellington horn section. And it absolutely, watching him do it and looking out from backstage and seeing the audience react, it was like, well, we're on radio, so opening my mouth doesn't make any difference. But everybody, you know, was like gasping.
A fair amount of live music. Let me say something against live records for a second.
Go.
And that is that, you know, sometimes an audience brings out the worst part of a musician. Sometimes the best, but sometimes the worst in the sense that the most show busy parts of somebody's playing will really be brought out by, you know, lots of applause. You know, the most boring, long drum solo will get a ton of applause if the drummer's playing
real
fast.
Right. One of the reasons, I agree with you, one of the reasons that I feel real good about having a live label is I can sit there and only pick out what works.
Yeah.
So the self-indulgent, you know, those long, bizarre, I'm going to knock them on their, you know, off their feet kind of, you know, silly things. We don't have those.
Cannonball Adderley on the record with him. There's a beautiful recording of Stars Fell on Alabama.
Yeah.
Tell me something about this recording and why you included it.
Well, I listened to 520 tapes to get the Les McCann record, 60 tapes to get the Eddie Harris record, 178 tapes to get the Rahsaan Roland Kirk record, one tape to get the Cannonball Adderley, two tapes, I'm sorry, to get the Cannonball Adderley. It just jumped out of the... It was just one of those nights where everything was right. We got those tapes from Las Vegas, a disc jockey who moved there from New York, who had done some live radio shows at the Half Note. I was always a big Cannonball Adderley fan. I was thrilled. And interestingly, that was a very rare period for Cannon. It was just before he became a big kind of like pop jazz artist, and it was just at the end of when he was a major commercial jazz and artistic jazz success, kind of on the cusp of careers. The interesting thing about Stars Fell in Alabama, if you listen to it, or an interesting thing to me is, that was done New Year's Eve in 1967, or New Year's Eve 68, whatever, however it goes, in New York, and musicians traditionally hate to play New Year's. It's the worst time in the world. Everybody's drunk, nobody cares, they're just out to scream and yell, you know, and get loaded. The audience is barely paying attention to him if you listen. There's a lot of noise. You hear all these conversations going on. And through all of this, on the worst night of the year for any musician, you just hear Cannon rise to this magnificent level. I thought that was a... He's recorded that song twice, and I heard him play it in person maybe a dozen times. He sounded like if Johnny Hodges and Bird had a son, it would have been Cannon then. And I thought it was a real touching performance.
Are any of the musicians getting angry at the people who recorded that, them without letting the musicians
sometimes
know what was happening?
I would say there are two instances. In the 4.5 years we've been doing it where two people got livid. At that point, we gave them the tapes, said, you know, sorry, if you're bugged, they're yours. Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Here's what I found. When I first went into this, one of the reasons I approached it with some kind of trepidation was people used to get livid when they found that they were recorded in an unauthorized manner. It's 30 years later. A lot of times, that's the best work they ever did, or that period's never coming back again. Or they, instead of getting angry, they say, man, I thought I'd never hear me playing with so-and-so, or that was a great period, for, you know. So it's different now. Is it all peaches and cream? Absolutely not. But I'd say 85, 90% of the time, people go, great, man, and love it.
Joel Dorn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Joel Dorn is the founder of Night Records. He's now working on an album by Mose Allison and an anthology of New Orleans pianists. Here's more from the Cannonball Adderley album, Radio Nights. This is Fresh Air.